for is essential to the military's ability to fulfill its principal mission and to provide national security. What weight, if would you give to that kind of a comment or statement or testimony by the military in considering any issue dealing with affirmative action?
Well, the weight it was given was to help satisfy the test, because the court, as you know, in Grutter, applied strict scrutiny because it was dealing with considerations on the basis of race. And that required a showing of a compelling governmental interest to support that legislative action. And the testimony of the military officers, as the court explained, helped substantiate the compelling nature of the interest in having a diverse student body. And that was the weight that the court gave it. There was, of course, the other case. There were two Michigan cases, the law school case and the university case, the Gratz case, where the court did say that it looked too much like a quota in that case because it was given determinative consideration as opposed to being one of a variety of factors that is considered. And the two cases together kind of show where the court is coming out, at least in the area of higher education. The court permits consideration of race or ethnic background so long as it's not sort of a make-or-break test.
Well, do you agree then with Justice O'Connor, writing for the majority, that gave great weight to the real-world impact of affirmative policies in universities? And the reason I've got 35 seconds left, that you might say, well, this may eventually come on up before the court. But the fact is, we know how every other justice has voted because they've all voted. And the American people would like to know where you stand on this very important public policy issue, particularly since Sandra Day O'Connor wrote such a compelling decision that was, I think, in the cause of fairness and justice.
Well, Senator, I think I can answer the specific questions you asked, because as you phrased the question, do you agree with her that it's important to look at the real-world significance and impact? And I can certainly say that I do think that that is the appropriate approach, without commenting on the outcome or the judgment in a particular case, that you do need to look at the real-world impact in this area, and I think in other areas as well.
Thank you very much. My time's up. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Senator Kennedy. We will now take a 15-minute break. Okay. We will reconvene at 11:25.
You're listening to live coverage of the John Roberts confirmation hearings from NPR News. I'm Neil Conant, along with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg in the Hart Senate office building on Capitol Hill. Senator Specter has just announced a 15-minute break after the first morning session. Today, we heard the last two senators from the first round of questioning getting an opportunity for half an hour with nominee Judge Roberts, and then the beginning of the second round where each senator gets 20 minutes, and we've gone through a few of those. Nina Totenberg, a couple of issues coming up today that had not been focused on thus far. One of them involving the case, this brought up by a couple of the Republicans in this hearing, involving their concerns over foreign precedents being cited in the Supreme Court.
There is a sort of raging debate about the tendency of some justices on the court to cite foreign law as sort of a background that justifies their opinion or that buttresses their opinion. Now, there is no case in which the Supreme Court, any justices of the Supreme Court, has relied on a foreign law or decision or court to make a controlling decision. Because England ruled that, we should rule that way too. What they do is they sort of use it to buttress their argument. So, for example, when the court, by a 5-4 vote, Justice Kennedy writing, said that executing juveniles is unconstitutional, he said, in buttressing his argument, and also this is cruel and unusual punishment under the current standards of modern society. He cited a bunch of stuff that had happened in the United States, and he said, and also look at what's happened in foreign countries. There's only a handful of foreign countries that allow people under 18 to be executed, and those are countries we hate, like, you know, we view them as barbaric, and so why would we want to be in the same boat. Now, there are a number of justices who don't think you should ever do that, that those words foreign countries should not cross your lips in a Supreme Court opinion about such things. This is a debate that, for example, Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer have had. It is, frankly, a debate that has more sound and fury than substance because, as I said, it doesn't control, but there was a proposal, and I suspect that Senator Coburn, who asked about it, was one of the proposers to impeach any justice who cited foreign law. And you heard the nominee, John Roberts, today say, well, I don't really think that's a grounds for impeachment. It's a grounds for discussion when you disagree among yourselves. I should say, Neil, I did a long piece about this at one point, and I was just fascinated that in the end, one of the people I interviewed for it was Richard Posner, who's a very distinguished, very conservative judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Or is it the Sixth Circuit, Tom? Seventh Circuit. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and based in Chicago. And he's a critic of citing foreign law. And he explained that, you know, why would you cite foreign law when there are whole different cultures that lead to that law? For example, there are more restrictive laws on abortion in Germany because of the history of the Holocaust, for example. It's not the same as our culture. And just doesn't make any sense. But in the end, he admitted that none of these are controlling. So, and I said to him, so, Judge, why is there such a big fight about this? And he said, well, because it's window dressing, and it's good window dressing. And if you're making an argument, you don't want the other side to have good window dressing. You want them to be operating on the same plane as you are. You don't want to let them be able to dress the doll or the model better than you can.
Tom Goldstein, you argue cases in front of the Supreme Court. He's our legal analyst here in the booth. I mean, are you taking your case in your hands if you cite some foreign precedent?
It is amazing how divisive the issue has become and how much attention has gone into it. I tend to agree that it never really is what causes a majority of the court to go one way or the other. The one exception, and there's a very interesting article in The New Yorker about this now, might be Justice Kennedy, who now is in the center of the court and really does seem to care a great deal about how other countries view questions. I also wanted to talk just more generally about how things went this morning. And if you look at sort of internet reactions to the testimony this morning and yesterday afternoon, it is interestingly...
Tom's our resident blogger.
Yes.
He has a blog called SCOTUS Blog, meaning SCOTUS stands for Supreme Court of the United States. But go ahead, Tom.
Sure. I think that the people who are most worried at this moment are conservatives, not liberals. Now, nobody thinks that John Roberts is going to be a liberal justice. Nobody thinks that John Roberts is going to be in the mold of, there's always the phrase for conservatives, no more suitors, referring to the appointment by President Bush of David Souter, who turned out to be a relatively moderately liberal justice. But what John Roberts has done is, on a number of issues that are very important to conservative constituencies, is given them heartache. Now, we don't know how he will rule when he gets to the court, but there was discussion today of property rights. And John Roberts said, look, the Supreme Court said in this past year that the government can take your property for broader business redevelopment. And John Roberts said, well, what? He seemed to embrace the idea that, and then what happened was terrific, and that is that people went to their legislatures, to their town councils, and said, we should not be using eminent domain. And he seemed to think that that was the way the process was supposed to work. In addition, he talked this morning about an issue that Nina has raised, and that's jurisdiction stripping. That's the power of Congress to say that the Supreme Court can't hear particular kinds of cases, say abortion cases. And conservatives have for many years attempted to enact bills that would take certain issues out of the hands of a Supreme Court that they think is too liberal. And John Roberts said that the Supreme Court has read Congress's power in that regard pretty narrowly, and he seemed to embrace that precedent because he really does seem to be someone who's trying to convey the impression that he's not trying to change the law. And so I do think, coming back to the point I first made, that this is causing conservatives who are hoping for a more aggressive conservative nominee in the mold of Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, that they're worried.
Nina, is this coming off when Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, says, I've heard your discussions in a couple of areas, Judge Roberts, and I was pleasantly surprised at that point conservatives start asking questions?
Well, maybe. But what I think, I don't think you really have had much in the way of commitments from John Roberts. What you have is a guy who I think has begun to realize that he is actually going to be the Chief Justice of the United States. And although we've had 43 presidents, if he's confirmed, we will have only 17 Chief Justices. This is incredibly small number of people who have this position. And I do think that Roberts as a justice may have been different than Roberts as Chief Justice, in the same way that Justice, Associate Justice Rehnquist, was quite different and, one might say, more conservative, more radical, more whatever you want to say, more aggressive than Chief Justice Rehnquist. Because the job of the Chief Justice, as you heard one discussion here today, is as much as possible to get the court to act cohesively in a collegial manner, to make it a functional institution, to win respect from the country, and also to get the respect of your colleagues. And so I think that what you heard today is in some ways a conflict between what the conservative movement would like, which is somebody who will roll back a lot of decisions that they don't like, and a nominee who is very conservative in many ways, including the traditional way of not rocking the boat too much too fast. That doesn't mean to say he won't rock it. I could be dead wrong on this. I mean, you know, he may just take the tiller and turn the ship of the court right around and sail one entire different direction. But that doesn't seem to be what he was suggesting today. I think what he'll do is take the tiller. Based on what you'd see here today, you would imagine somebody who would take the tiller and move it gradually, as much as possible, in a rightward direction. And that is not what sort of the Republican base of very activist folks want right now and have been led to believe they can get when the president has the chance to nominate people to the court.
And in fact, yes, in fact, you wouldn't really see the tiller move at all, perhaps, because John Roberts is, of course, replacing William Rehnquist, who already was quite conservative. And so conservatives, probably conservative activists, may really have had too high expectations to have to say we're going to replace a conservative with another conservative and further our agenda or how our view to our view of the rule of law, where John Roberts seems to be much more interested, at least as he's expressing it today and yesterday, in stability and continuing the course.
Well, and also they're going to get another nomination, and of course this will increase the internal fight within the Republican Party over what kind of nominee that's going to be. You don't really want to win confirmation by a very narrow margin, and I think it looks increasingly as if John Roberts' margin will not be narrow. I think it's probably even more important for the Chief Justice, but it's at least in the beginning of your tenure, you would like to have a significant number of Democrats. And I think that what Roberts is trying to do here is reassure the Democrats that he's not some sort of a flaming conservative who's going to set fire to every important decision that matters to Democrats.
Democrats on the committee and in general have been concerned by some of those remarks that he made in the famous memos back in the Reagan administration, remarks that seemed to critics as being either a flip or smart alecky or arrogant, depending on which critic you wanted to listen to. Today, in a discussion of the death penalty with Senator Leahy, it was one of those moments where perhaps you saw that side of John Roberts emerge when he was being asked about whether if there are four justices who would wish to grant a review to a death penalty case, would he not agree that a fifth should sign on almost automatically, should be maybe even the Chief Justice sign on almost automatically to get that case reviewed?
Well, this arises from a situation in the case in which Roberts was involved in the brief when he was in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration. By that, I mean the administration of the president's father. And he was the deputy solicitor general, and there was a death case. And there were four votes on the court to review the case. That's what you need, four votes to review the case. But there was not a fifth vote to grant a stay of execution. And the defendant, who was eventually executed, it finally derived down to a state court at the last minute, very much the 11th hour, to grant a stay of execution. And he said today that, well, it would make sense to have that fifth vote because you wouldn't want to have review granted and then have the case mooted by an execution. And I didn't think he saw the humor of that. I thought it was a moment where he was obviously looking at an issue in a very legalistic way, and Senator Leahy, who is very passionate about the death penalty and very passionately opposed to the death penalty, I suspect was not terribly reassured by that.
Tom Goldstein, let me ask you about another subject that came up today, and this had to do, I think this was in Senator Spector's question line when he began the second round of questions from the senators, and that was his concern about the number of 5-4 decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, one of which he said, you know, when number A writes an opinion joined by B in part, which is joined by C, and then he said, you get a patchwork of confusion, and asked the nominee what he would do should he be confirmed to try to build consensus on the court.
Well, this really is one of the areas where, as Nina says, John Roberts as an associate justice would have had a different job than his position as Chief Justice of the United States. John Roberts is in a real dilemma when it comes to answering this question because as the Chief Justice, you can't make anybody do anything. So he's reduced to saying nice things about how he will really listen to his colleagues and encourage them all to work together. I do think that the court over the past several years has come together more. We've had somewhat fewer 5-4 decisions. The opinions have been more coherent because this group of justices until recently has been together for going on 11 years. And so there really isn't all that much he can do other than to be a persuader and a good listener, which by all accounts from these hearings he appears to be.
You know, we think of 5-4 decisions as a relatively recent phenomenon, but it's not. And I'd like to point out that the Miranda decision was 5-4. And by the time that Chief Justice Rehnquist, who'd been an opponent of Miranda, embraced it as a embedded part of our culture, it was no longer thought of as even a contested issue. And that decision was 7-2.
Yet the instance that is consistently cited is Chief Justice Warren's effort to get a unanimous decision from the court in Brown versus Board of Education, which everybody recognized at the time as being precedent-breaking.
That's right. You know, Earl Warren had the advantage of having been governor of California, and John Roberts is in the difficult position of having been a lawyer from Washington. You really don't have the political skills in your background that you do when you have to run an entire state. Maybe I can also provide one other point of background because there's been so much discussion of the effects test and the intent test that may just fly over the heads.
In the Voting Rights Act.
Yes, exactly. Senator Kennedy's talked a lot about this, and then the Republicans have tried to respond. Just to sort of simplify things a bit, there's a federal law that makes it illegal to discriminate against people on the basis of their race in designing voting systems, if we'll have an at-large election or if we're going to change the voting systems. There's a provision of the statute called Section 2, and there was a big fight over whether or not to make out a violation of Section 2, you had to prove that the government was intentionally discriminating on the basis of race, or if whatever it was doing, even if by accident, had an effect on race. It was an extremely divisive issue. It was ultimately resolved after the Supreme Court said you have to do it on purpose. They amended the statute to adopt the effects test.
If you're just joining us, we're in a break here at the Senate Judiciary Committee, a 15-minute morning break. Senators have begun the second round of questioning. We've gone through the most senior members of the committee already. When we return, it'll be the opportunity for Charles Grassley of Iowa, Republican, to resume the questioning of John Roberts, who's been nominated, of course, to be Chief Justice of the United States. The nominee is back at the witness table. The senators have yet to return. Nina?
You know, we were talking about the Chief Justice Warren's ability and how hard he worked to get a unanimous opinion in Brown versus the board. He also had the advantage of succeeding a rather unsuccessful Chief Justice, Chief Justice Vinson. Felix Frankfurter, Associate Justice Felix Frankfurter, was quoted by one of his law clerks as saying that when Chief Justice Vinson died and word came to Frankfurter, he said to the clerk, "This is the first real evidence I've ever had that there is a God." So Warren came onto the court, and I interviewed law clerks from that period who said it was like sunshine suddenly came into the court. And even though his was a recess appointment, he hadn't even been voted on yet, he immediately started talking to other members of the court, and he spent months and months just talking to them to try to figure out what was doable and to reach some consensus. It was an extraordinary feat. And he succeeded in this very important case. But after that, of course, there were lots of 5-4 decisions in other cases. And he couldn't do that in every case.
Mm-hmm. Tom Goldstein, isn't that the same kind of comparison people draw to when Judge Roberts' mentor, William Rehnquist, took over as Chief Justice, the operations of the Burger Court suddenly smoothed out a lot more quickly?
That is exactly right. It's a very interesting comparison. When William Rehnquist came in as Chief Justice, he was regarded and has really been applauded as an incredibly effective Chief Justice, both because he did a great job, but also because expectations were very low. Berger was regarded as very pompous and ineffective. John Roberts has the opposite problem.
Warren Berger being the previous Chief Justice.
Yes, his predecessor. John Roberts has the opposite problem. The court runs very smoothly now. William Rehnquist, though quite conservative, was admired by judges and officials on the left and the right for his administrative skill, for his even-handedness. John Roberts seems to have those same skills, but if he doesn't do as good a job, and remember, he's only been a judge for a couple of years, it's a complicated job, he's running an enormously complicated judicial system, his expectations are much higher in the wake of the departure and death of William Rehnquist.
Nina Totenberg, let me ask you a question about scheduling, and I don't mean to be premature, but we do know that the committee hopes to be through with this hearing by the end of the week. Whether we go into Friday or not is still at issue, but by the end of the week, no matter what. At what point would the committee then have a vote on this nomination, and at what point, presuming that it does go ahead and is approved by the committee, at what point would it go to the Senate floor?
The chairman has said he'd like to have a vote on Tuesday the 20th, and I've not heard anybody saying they wouldn't vote then. The chairman had consulted with the ranking member, Patrick Leahy, when he made that announcement. And then I think the idea is that the nomination would go to the floor likely the following week, which would give the Senate a week to debate the nomination, vote on the nomination, and John Roberts could then be in his seat for the opening of the Supreme Court term on the first Monday in October.
And at this point, what do we think about the possibility of there's eventually going to be a second nomination, this to replace the retiring Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Would that come presumably after the Senate has voted on the Roberts nomination?
Well, Laura Bush seemed to suggest that. There is, of course, the possibility that it could come after the committee vote. But my guess is that they may want to wait, get this under their belts, and then nominate somebody. I'm not privy to what the president's thinking is on this, and I'm not sure that anybody really outside is. So I guess we're going to just have to wait and see. I certainly by the end of the first or second week in October, we should have a nominee.
Tom Goldstein, might that involve that the answer to that question involve gauging political reaction to what's been happening here?
It absolutely does. I think there's a calculus about whether or not the Democrats can try and force a hold on the Roberts nomination until the next nominee is identified. But the other thing is a very practical consideration that people sometimes miss. We think of the White House as having sort of limitless resources, but a confirmation process is an extremely, extremely detailed effort involving dozens of people in the administration and all of their outside supporters, and they are totally focused on this effort right now, to put out another nominee would be very, very difficult for them, because that nominee would come under attack, and being able to defend, if you will, in political terms, a two-front war is something that they really don't want to do. This is the reason, for example, that people doubted the president would elevate someone from an associate justice position to the chief justice and have two confirmation proceedings at once.
Senator Spector has come back into the room and is taking his chair as I speak, and we should be getting back to questions for Judge John Roberts in just a moment. And next up, as we mentioned earlier, will be Charles Grassley, a Republican of Iowa.
A few minutes tardy because we just finished the vote, and we now turn to Senator Grassley for his 20-minute second round.
Thank you. Once again, compliment you on how you've handled yourself at these hearings. You've done very well. It's going to be very hard for people to cast a no vote against you. Judge Roberts, do you believe that every citizen who meets the qualifications set forth in the Constitution and our laws should have the opportunity to cast a free and unfettered vote? And as a follow-up, will you, on the court, fairly apply the Voting Rights Act?
Well, I certainly agree that every citizen who meets the qualifications not only has a right to vote, but should vote. I think it's a problem that we don't have more people voting. And any issues that come before me under the Voting Rights Act, I will confront those with an open mind and decide them after full and fair consideration of the arguments in light of the precedents of the court and in light of a recognition of the critical role that the right to vote is plays as preservative of all other rights.
Thank you. The Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that the legislative history of a particular bill is critical to interpretation of the statute. Of course, Justice Scalia is of the opinion that most expressions of legislative history, like committee reports or statements by the senators on the floor or the House, are not entitled to great weight because they are unreliable indicators of legislative intent. Presumably, Judge Scalia believes that if the members don't actually write a report or don't actually vote on a report, then there's no need to defer to this expression of congressional intent. Now, obviously, I have great regard for Justice Scalia, his intellect, legal reasoning, but of course, as I told you in our office, I don't really agree with his position. So asking you, I'd like to ask you five questions. They're relatively short, so I'll ask them all at once. What is your opinion? How important is legislative history to you? How have you utilized it? And will it be any different from your use on the circuit court versus what you might do on the Supreme Court? And did you refer to any committee reports or congressional debate in any of your 39 briefs before the Supreme Court? And to what extent do you, and don't start out with this last one, to what extent do you share Justice Scalia's view on unreliability of legislative history, although that's important? I'd like, and I can repeat those if you forget what I've asked.
Sure. Well, if I leave one out, you can remind me at the end. But obviously, when you're dealing with interpreting a statute, the most important part is the text. You begin with the text, and as the Supreme Court has said, in many cases, perhaps most cases, that's also where you end. The answer is clear. I have, though, as a judge, relied on legislative history to help clarify ambiguity in the text. The Supreme Court stated once, and I think it's a very important principle, you look to legislative history to clarify ambiguity. You don't look to legislative history to create ambiguity. In other words, if the text is clear, that is what you follow, and that's binding. And you don't look beyond it to say, well, if you look here, though, maybe this clear word should be interpreted a different way. On the other hand, we confront situations where the text is not clear, and the legislative history can be helpful in resolving that ambiguity. It requires a certain sensitivity to what you're dealing with. All legislative history is not created equal. There's a difference between the weight that you give a conference report and the weight you give a statement of one legislator on the floor. You have to, I think, have some degree of sensitivity in understanding exactly what you're looking at, appreciate where those comments were made in the legislative process, be careful to make sure that they're dealing with the same language that was eventually adopted. You have to, for example, be very skeptical about statements by opponents of the bill. It's quite a common thing saying, well, this bill would do this, this, and this, and so we shouldn't pass it. That's not always the best guide as to what the sponsors really intended in the language. So it does require a certain sensitivity to what you're dealing with. But I have quoted and looked to legislative history in the past to help determine the meaning of ambiguous terms, and I would expect to follow that same approach on the Supreme Court. I don't think there's a difference there in terms of what things you think it is appropriate to look to help you do your job, which is to figure out what Congress intended.
And you didn't address Judge Scalia, but let me put it another way so I don't put you in a bad position. You would see, at least in some instances where it needs to be used, reliability in legislative history.
Reliability, in some instances, I think if you look at it carefully, you can make an assessment that this is a reliable guide. And one area I didn't touch on in my arguments, I've certainly relied on legislative history in presenting arguments because, of course, in the Supreme Court, you need five votes and not just the one. So you tend to cast your net as widely as possible. And at argument, sometimes Justice Scalia would not be as receptive to an argument based on legislative history as some of the others. But again, the name of the game is counting to five when you're arguing up there. And so I've certainly made arguments based on legislative history.
Okay. In regard to how you view and use legislative history, I'd like to discuss your opinion in Totten Bombardier Corporation case interpreting the False Claims Act. The issue on appeal was whether Bombardier had met the presentment requirements of the False Claims Act. To violate the statute, according to Section 3729A1, a company must have presented its false claim to an officer or employee of the federal government. Importantly, Section 3729C explicitly provides that the term claim includes demands for payments submitted to government contractors, whether or not they are resubmitted to the federal government. In your opinion, you wrote that those facts of that case did not consist of a false claims under the False Claims Act because there can only be a false claims if it's literally presented to somebody that's a federal government employee, I assume. It seems to me that to reach this result, you inserted a resubmission requirement into the law in place where it doesn't, in fact, appear, Section 3729A1, and in fact gave short shrift to the legislative history, which spelled out what Congress intended when it amended the Act in 86. The legislative history of the Act in the Senate Committee Report, now I didn't refer to my authorship of the legislation, but anyway, in our Senate Committee Report, explaining that liability under the False Claims Act attaches to a submission of, and I quote, a false claim to the recipient of a grant from the United States or to a state under a program financed in part by the United States, end of quote. The legislative history also states that Congress sought to ensure that, quote, a false claims was actionable, although the claim or false statements were made to a party other than the government, if the payment thereon would ultimately result in a loss to the United States, end of quote. So my question is whether, on reflection, that is a fair way to deal with the express wishes of Congress, and whether it is possible that you misunderstood the statute when you decided Totten case, and why did you reject legislative history if you referred to it, and maybe you didn't refer to it, but why did you reject legislative history regarding the resubmission requirement in the False Claims Act when you wrote the opinion in Totten?
Well, Senator, the answer to your question is it's certainly possible that the majority in that case didn't get it right, and the dissent that was a very strong dissent did get it right. I think the majority got it right. There we focused on particular language. The issue in the case involved, as you know, a subcontractor claim. You have the United States giving money to, in this case it was Amtrak, and then Amtrak using that money to hire a subcontractor, I think it was Bombardier, to do a particular part of the job. Everybody agreed that under the precedents that are applied, Amtrak is not the government. It can't be considered part of the government. And the statute, as you noted, required, it was triggered by the presentment of a false claim to an officer or employee of the United States. And the majority's reasoning was that when the false claim was one made by Bombardier to Amtrak, and that claim was submitted to Amtrak, and since Amtrak was not the government, what Judge Rogers and I concluded was that that wasn't presentment of a false claim to an officer or employee of the United States. There was an extensive discussion in between the majority and the dissent. The view that you've articulated was certainly presented in a compelling way by Judge Garland, my colleague on the Court of Appeals, and we spent a great deal of time on the case, and I think it's reflected in the opinions. And that view was laid out. Judge Rogers and I thought that the statutory language that said the claim had to be presented to an officer employee presented too high a hurdle for us to get over in looking at the legislative history. But I'm happy to concede that it was among the more difficult cases I've had over the past 2 years. Anytime Judge Garland disagrees, you know you're in a difficult area, and the function of his dissent to make us focus on what we were deciding and to make sure that we felt we were doing the right thing, I think, was well served. But Judge Garland disagreed, and so it's obviously to me a case on which reasonable judges can disagree, and I just have to rest on the analysis and the majority opinion.
Let me tell you something you might not be aware of, and that is that the Bush administration has filed an amicus brief in the 11th Circuit arguing that you had misread the False Claims Act in the Totten case. And in Atkins versus McIntyre, the administration has argued that there's no presentment requirement in Section 3730A2 of the False Claims Act, and that, quote, the Totten majority misconstrued the language and purpose of the False Claims Act in concluding that the Act does not encompass false claims record statements submitted to recipients of federal funds absent resubmission to a United States officer or employee. And I assume if I ask you if you have an opinion on that, you can't answer it.
Well, not on that one. I do know the Bush administration filed an amicus brief in our case as well. I guess this would be one of those cases I would cite in response to the question of whether I'm capable of ruling against the administration. We did in that case. The arguments, I think, were well presented on both sides, and Judge Rogers and I gave it our best shot, and the opinion will stand or fall on its own.
Well, I hope sitting in the Marble Palace you'll remember that I have great pride in the success of the False Claims Act. $8 billion coming back to the Federal Treasury. Judge Roberts, you filed an amicus brief in the case of United States versus Halper, a case which raised the question of whether a civil False Claims Act case could implicate double jeopardy clause. The Supreme Court agreed with your arguments and held that double jeopardy clause protects a convicted criminal defendant from a second punishment in the form of a civil sanction that, quote, may not fairly be characterized as remedial, end of quote, because it is, quote, overwhelmingly disproportionate to the damage the defendant has caused, end of quote. As you know, the Halper decision was later overturned by Hudson. Judge Roberts, do you consider the False Claims Act treble damages provisions to be excessive, in the words of the court, overwhelmingly disproportionate, and also in the words of the court, not fairly characterized as remedial?
Well, you've touched on a case that's very close to my heart, Senator. It was the first case I argued before the Supreme Court. I was appointed by the court to argue it on behalf of Mr. Halper. It was an unusual case. It arose, the conspiracy at issue was a slight inflation of, I believe it was Medicare or Medicaid claims that this individual was submitting. I think he added a dollar or $2 to every claim. And yet, under the law at that time, there was a minimum penalty for each false claim. So these numbers won't be right, but he had something like 300 false claims for a grand total of maybe $700. But under the statute, he was assessed a civil penalty of several million dollars because each of the false claims was a separate penalty. And the issue was, after having been sentenced criminally, would a civil penalty of several, and again, I'm not sure the numbers, but several million dollars for $700 or so of fraud, was that remedial and civil, or was it punishment? And the court agreed with my submission at the time that that was punishment. It led to some difficulty, I think, in administering civil and criminal laws down the line. And as you said, 8 years later, they reversed course and overruled the helper precedent. But the provision that you specifically mentioned, treble damages, that's a little different. There, it's a much closer connection, obviously just three times whatever the damages are. In the helper case, it was a much more disproportionate impact, and that's what led the court, I think, to conclude that that looks like punishment. Treble damages is something that's familiar in the law in a number of areas and is not regarded as impermissible punishment in this context.
Are you familiar with the legal arguments that some opponents of the False Claims Act have made to the effect that its QI-TAM provisions are unconstitutional under Articles 2 and 3? And if so, do you have an opinion on these arguments? And before you answer, I'd like to remind you that at least since the first Congress was involved in this, I'd like to assume that the framers of the Constitution, because the first Congress enacted several QI-TAM statutes, that if that be any deference to you in giving whether this fact would make any difference to you when assessing the constitutionality of QI-TAM statutes today.
I think, if my memory serves, that the Article 3 objections, and just so we're on the same page, the QI-TAM statutes, of course, are when a private individual brings suit on behalf of the government for fraud on the government and in return gets a percentage of the recovery. And as you noted, it's been, under the False Claims Act, very successful in securing recovery of funds on behalf of the government. The Vermont case, and I'm not remembering it any more than that, it was a case from Vermont, I think addressed most of the Article 3 issues. The objection was that individual has no standing, I think, because he doesn't necessarily have an interest. And what the court said was that the individual has standing as a result of the bounty, if you will, the percentage he gets, that satisfies the standing requirement. So those objections are out of the way. I do know that some have raised additional objections under Article 2, which go to the fact that this might interfere with the executive's authority to execute the law. In other words, you have private individuals bringing suit. I'm not sure that those issues have been finally resolved. Obviously, if those cases do come up, I'll want to keep an open mind. The factor you mentioned, obviously, about historic practice, that is something that the court does look to in assessing constitutionality. If it's something that the founders were familiar with or a practice that they engaged in and showed no disagreement with, that, while not determinative, that is a factor that the court would look at. I don't know if any of those cases are going to come before the court, but if they do, that's one of the considerations that will have to be taken into account.
Other than Totten case and the Helper case, have you ever written or spoken publicly about the issue of the constitutionality of QI-TAMs or any other provisions of the False Claims Act to your memory?
I don't remember any, no, Senator.
Okay. Judge Roberts, in 1986, while serving as an associate White House counsel, you approved Reagan administration testimony regarding Whistleblower Protection Act of 86. You probably recall that the Reagan administration opposed that legislation, which is now law. Could you explain what role, if any, you had in formulating the administration's position on the Whistleblower Protection Act?
I don't recall any role, Senator. Our office, the counsel's office, would routinely review testimony that was about to be given. We were just looking out for particular constitutional concerns or issues. We generally did not get into the substance. The substance of that would have been shaped over in the Justice Department, and we would have really been looking out for anything that we thought infringed on the constitutional authorities of the President or presented other consistency issues. But the substance of the testimony is not something I was involved in.
Do you feel that you have any bias against False Claims Act or the Whistleblower Protection Act that would impact on your ability to fairly decide cases on those statutes?
No, Senator. I have had some whistleblower cases in different aspects. I do recall coming up in the Court of Appeals, and I think in some cases we ruled in favor, in some cases we ruled against. So I have seen those cases and have had no difficulty fairly and objectively deciding them.
Are you against cameras in the courtroom like Justice Rehnquist was?
Well, you know, my new best friend, Senator Thompson, assures me that television cameras are nothing to be afraid of. I don't have a set view on that. I do think it's something that I would want to listen to the views of, if I were confirmed, to my colleagues.
I would suggest then to the chairman that we move quickly on that bill before he's got an opinion on it.
I intend to do just that, Senator Grassley, now that I have your support.
Thank you.
Former Senator Thompson, now the star of Law and Order on NBC TV.
Morning, Judge. How are you?
And
morning,
this is Joseph Biden, Democrat of Delaware.
I went back and looked at something you said yesterday, which was reminded. I was reminded by my son, who's done some appellate work, nothing like you. And he said, I thought I heard him say this, and then I went to staff, got it. Yesterday morning, you said, I went back once and counted the questions during my half hour. There were over 100 questions the court asked. So you're not at all offended by us interrupting you like we do. You're used to being interrupted, aren't you?
I'm used to being interrupted before the court. That's for sure, Senator.
Well,
yes.
we're kind of the court here. We're kind of the court. You're not entitled to the job. God love you. You've been nominated, and your job is to demonstrate that there's no presumption, as you well know. So I hope you won't mind some questions. I promise I won't interrupt if you give short answers.
Okay? I'll try, Senator.
All right. Great. I'd like to follow up on yesterday. I asked you if you agreed there was a right of privacy to be found in the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment, and you said, and I quote, I do, Senator. I think if my reading of the precedent is correct, I think every justice on the court believes that to some extent or another. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, one of the things that's been amazing, and you are one of the best witnesses that I think has come before this committee, and I've been here 30-some years, is that you've convinced the folks who share Senator Brownback's view that you're going to be just right for them, and you convinced the folks that share Senator Kennedy's view that you're going to be just right for them. I'd like to plumb a little bit more closely this notion of how you view this right of privacy. Now, if you take a look at Justice Scalia's comment about that right to privacy, found the 14th Amendment is related to the Casey case, he said, the issue is whether abortion is liberty protected by the Constitution of the United States. I am sure it is not, because of two simple facts. The Constitution says absolutely nothing about it, and the longstanding traditions, etc. Then, on that same case, the quote coming from, I've got to make sure I get the right justice here, from O'Connor, Kennedy and Souter dissent, they said, the liberty of a woman is at stake in a sense unique to the human condition and so unique to the law. The mother who carries a child a full term is subject to anxieties and physical constraints, the pain that only she must bear. Her suffering is too intimate and personal for the state to insist without more upon its own version of woman's role. Two fundamentally different views of the right to privacy as it relates to that issue. In Cruzan, The case relating to whether or not fully competent adults have the right to refuse unwanted medical treatment. Justice Scalia said in his opinion that, quote, that the federal court have no business in this field, that American law has always accorded the state the power to prevent, by force if necessary, suicide, including suicide by refusing appropriate measures necessary to preserve one's life. Justice Kennedy, in the same case, as you well, I know you know all this, but it's, I just want to try to get a sense where you are. He said, liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, freedom of expression, belief. Let me restate it. Liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain intimate conduct. The instant case involves liberty of the person both in its spatial and in its transcendental dimensions. Obviously, fundamentally different. And then the same goes when he talks about when O'Connor says, I agree that the protected liberty interest in refusing unwanted medical treatment may be inferred from our prior decisions and that refusal of artificially delivered food or water is encompassed within the liberty interest. Justice Brennan. So the point I'm making is obvious that there are very, very, very disparate views. Can you tell me what side you come down closer on?
Well, Senator, first
I'm
of all,
I'm asking you to comment on any case.
Well, I can say that it is my view that all of the justices, I think of the case like the Glucksberg case, in which the majority subscribed to the view that there is an appropriate mode of analysis to determine the content of the Liberty Clause, that it does include protection beyond physical restraint, and that that protection applies in a substantive manner. Now, there are legal theorists, there are judges, jurists, who do not agree with that, who do not agree that there is a right of privacy protected under the Due Process Clause, who do not agree that the liberty protected extends beyond freedom from physical restraint. Their view is that it means you cannot be basically imprisoned or arrested without due process, and that means only that you get some type of procedural protection. That is not my understanding of where the justices on the Supreme Court are, and it's not my understanding. I believe that the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause is not limited to freedom from physical restraint, that it includes certain other protections, including the right to privacy. As you know, that the court has tried to map out in a series of cases that go back to Meyer versus Nebraska and Pierce and all that, and in various instances as the claims have arisen, and that it's protected not simply from procedural deprivation. That is.
If I may interrupt, that's not the question I ask you. I thank you for that lesson, and I understand what you're saying. I'm asking you a specific question.
Well, and
do you side more with within that context, with the views of Scalia and Thomas, would say that consenting adults do not have, whether if they're both male or female, do not have the right to engage in sexual conduct. The state can determine that. I mean, let me put it another way. My family faced, I'm sure many people in this audience's families faced,